Mr. Doug Fry, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about when you first arrived to join your squadron at Mildenhall in June 1943.
Yeah.
This is 15 Squadron. When was your first mission? What was the procedure when you arrived as to the first operational mission?
Before we operated, started operations as a crew, the skipper, our pilot, George Judd, had to do his mandatory second dickey or second pilot op with a experienced crew. So therefore, we were the gunners were in effect, and the rest of the crew, in fact, were spare at that particular time. It so happened that two or three days after arrival at the squadron, I bowled down to the crew room in A flight hangar, and there was another mid-upper gunner there as well. He had also just joined the squadron, and the gunnery leader came in and asked for a mid-upper for a flying officer, Hawkins, who was on the battle order for that night, but his mid-upper apparently hadn't put in an appearance. So I immediately said I'd go, and I was told to report to Flying Officer Hawkins after the briefing with my flying kit. I wasn't allowed into the briefing for some reason. However, having reported to Flying Officer Hawkins after they came out of the briefing room, I was told I wasn't needed because, after all, his mid-upper gunner had turned up. How fortunate can one be, because that night the target was Mülheim and they were all killed. So it seems to me that my luck, my good luck, in fact, had already started. So, 3 or 4 days after that, my skipper did his first second dickey. I think it was a target in France. And then we did our first operation.
Well, you were given an aeroplane first, weren't you? And you actually seem to remember the number.
By now, we had our own aeroplane allocated to us. It was a replacement for Flying Officer Hawkins A. Apple. Our aeroplane was brand new, delivered from the Short Works in Rochester, Kent, and the serial number was EF-427, allocated A. Apple.
And this was a Stirling?
This, of course, was the Stirling, Squadron Stirling Mark III's. And we were briefed.
Did you personalise it at all?
No.
So no.
We didn't. No. Eventually, I suppose it was personalised by virtue of the fact that our skipper had his fiancée's name written under the underneath the cockpit. Her name was Joyce. So our aircraft was A. Apple Joyce, which caused some amusement with the CO.
So you were issued with this aircraft.
So we now have our own aeroplane. We got busy cleaning it out. The turret, the mid-upper turret, which of course was my domain, had a few spots of dope still on it. So I got to work and washed that off, cleaned that off. So I had nice sparkling perspex.
Was that considered important?
It was very important to have very clear perspex, because anything could distract you at a crucial moment, especially when everything is dark and you just spot something out of the corner of your eye and get the wrong impression. So it was very important really to have everything absolutely spot on and clean. So we came to the point where it was our turn to do our first operation as a crew. This was a mining operation, which was the normal procedure for crews, whether they be new or otherwise, and we were taking 3 parachute mines to drop just off the Frisian Islands. We did this.
So what do you remember of that mission?
Well, this was, of course, it was quite exciting, really. It was our first operation, so we were going, in effect, into the unknown. However, we arrived over the Frisians, dropped our bearings, no problem at all, no problems from the flagships, which were always pottering about along the Frisians there. And so we dropped our mines in the appropriate spot, did an about turn, and got back to base safely.
And nothing untoward?
Nothing untoward at all. What we used to term,
do you know the date of that?
Tease a piece of cake. I can tell you from the do you need the date? I can get it off the operation sheets.
We'll probably leave it for now then.
Shall we? All right. Well, I mean, I can always give you a list and that can be inserted or something. I don't know. I don't know what you do. Anyway, so we got safely back from that little sortie. And quite pleased with ourselves, I think. And then the skipper did another second dickie, this time with the CO, who was Wing Commander Stevens. That was all right, as far as they were concerned. And then we went down one morning to see who was on the, if the battle order was up, and it was, and our name was on it. And at briefing, we learned that the target was in the dreaded Ruhr, and it was Wuppertal.
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 Now, what do you remember of this mission?
Now, this was also very exciting, in effect, because, and also a lot of apprehension, I think, was stirred here, because it being in the Ruhr, which was known to aircrew as Happy Valley, by virtue of the fact that it was not a happy valley, owing to the tremendous defences that it had there, especially with regard to flak. So that was it. We were doing our first land operation, as it were, and it was to the Ruhr. So off we went. We largely, on our squadron, and I think probably mostly for three group, we were what was termed arson. In other words, we carried all incendiaries, £4 and £30 incendiaries. So we were invariably third wave. If it was maximum effort, we were third wave. So we arrived at Wuppertal. The target was well alight, and I was absolutely stunned at the tremendous fires that were blazing down below. The smoke was up already to about 12,000 feet. And of course there was masses of flak coming up, and searchlights probing, and photo flashes going off, and the markers going down from the PFF aircraft. So we bombed on our markers. We had to go straight across the target after bombing and getting our picture. And then we did a fairly sharp right turn and came back more or less on a reciprocal, which took us past the target, which was then on our starboard side. As we were going, and I had a bird's eye view, in fact, of the other aircraft going in on their bombing run. We were flying straight and level on our course, going past the target, which was now on our right, as I said, and there was a whoosh, and a clang, and a clump, and a bit of shrapnel came through the perspex, just brushed across my legs, and clanged into the bottom of the turret. Fortunately, I hadn't been leaning forward looking through the sight at the time, otherwise it would probably taken my nose off. But it was obviously a bit of more or less spent shrapnel from bursting shells over the target. But nevertheless, it punched a hole in my brand new turret, which, of course, the ground crew repaired after we got back. So that was a bit of excitement and a little bit of flak for my pocket. So we got back safely from that one. Once more, we were pleased with ourselves.
What was your morale like? You know, how did you feel in yourself? Were you nervous before?
We were nervous. The nerves came on a bit when we saw our names on the battle order. Like that calmed down, and then when we got to briefing and saw what the target was, then those came on again a bit, but they eventually sort of disappeared really. And then once we got into the aircraft and we went about our business, whether it was up the rear end or the front end, we more or less calmed down. But the real apprehension then came back as we approached the target, and as far as I was concerned, I could turn my turret 360 degrees so I could look forward and see what was happening. And when you saw all the stuff going up there, and now and again you saw fighters going past looking for somebody else, that's when the adrenaline, as they say these days, started, and a slight bitter taste came in the mouth, really. But nevertheless, that really sharpened my senses and made you more alert, I think.
Now, we've just looked up your papers to get the dates, and the La Rochelle raid was 25th of June.
Right.
Wuppertal was the 24th.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
all on two nights, overnight, isn't
it? Yeah, 24th, 25th. Yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah. So the La Rochelle was our second mining op.
And that was on the 25th of June,
yes.
Yeah. Do you remember anything about that in particular?
No, except that was uneventful, really. We flew mostly over France to get there. And it was interesting to see there were some people on the ground flashing torches up at us, obviously, here and there, right across. And then we got to did our timed run off La Rochelle. And interestingly enough, our mine seemed to have been dropped right in the middle of a fishing fleet, because we could see the lights on the boats, and they were presumably a Spanish fishing fleet. So they may have had one or two surprises if they'd run into our mines. Anyway, excuse me, they were likewise three parachute mines. We did that okay, and we got back okay, and completely uneventful.
And then two bombing missions on Cologne, one
yes.
on the 28th of June,
yes.
28th, 29th, and one on the 3rd of July,
yes.
3rd, 4th
now
July.
The first Cologne was clear skies, so they were TIs, PA were dropping ground target indicators. That was a good raid. Likewise, we were third wave, as usual, and arson. Once again, the target was well alight when we got there. That was completely uneventful as well. It bombed on our markers, got home safely. Whilst all this was going on, our rear gunner hadn't actually operated with us. We'd been using spare rear gunners, because he was in Ely Hospital for a minor operation. So he didn't operate with us for the first five ops. So we were flying with a spare rear gunner. On this particular night of the second Cologne, although the Met officer, amid the usual jeers and boos, said that it would be clear over the target, when we got there it was 10/10 cloud. So PFF had to drop sky markers, so we were bombing through cloud, and of course heavily silhouetted against the cloud by virtue of the searchlights shining up underneath them. And whilst we were on our bombing run, this blooming rear gunner, and it was obviously his first op, just joined the squadron, he's in a strangled voice, he suddenly said, "Fighter." Well, I hadn't seen any fighters, and I just assumed that it was a flak burst that had got caught in the slipstream and got spread out like a wingspan. Anyway, I told the skipper, even though we were on our bombing run, to turn the aircraft over so that I could have a look underneath, just in case somebody was coming up beneath us. And there was nobody there. So that was a front of the life out of all of us. And in fact, when we got back, the skipper tore a strip off me for interrupting the bombing run, would you believe? I said, "Well, in future, they won't say a word," because all the crew didn't like that. So I think I won that round. Anyway, another thing happened with this on the way back from this particular Cologne. We were almost to the English coast, and it was now getting daylight, and it was still 10/10 cloud, and we were above the cloud. And we'd been told, and it had been started as routine, our night fighters were injecting themselves into the stream to try and protect us against the German night fighters. There would be both fighters and mosquitoes. Anyway, as we were coming in over the sea towards the English coast, the bow fighter came up behind us and slightly above us and on the starboard side, and I identified it immediately. But the rear gunner didn't say anything. He just opened fire at the blinking thing. And of course, it didn't take very kindly to that. So the skipper was a bit worried what was going on. I yelled out it was a bow fighter. The bow fighter cleared off. He wasn't having any of that. And I said to the skipper, well, if you're windy about it, if you don't believe me, you better get down in the cloud and hide ourselves. So that's what he did. But once more, that same rear gunner, you see, he lost his nerve, or he was tense or whatever. Or he was keen to fire the guns, I suppose. I don't know. But that was the sort of thing that happened, you see. When you've got somebody that is an absolute stranger to you, and I suppose he was excited for his first op and everything, and to me he did all the wrong things.
Did he settle down after that?
I don't know. I don't know what happened to him.
We didn't
fly with him again. No, we
was
did.
Was that deliberate? I mean, did you get rid of him?
No, because if he was now doing his ops with his crew. You see, he wouldn't be a permanent spare, so he wouldn't fly as a spare anymore. But we did have a chap, a Canadian, who was a regular spare, and he flew with us twice. He was a rather interesting chap, in that when we were speaking to one of the other crew members about we got him tonight, he said, oh dear, he said, you've got to watch him. He doesn't say anything, and he does tend to go to sleep. Doze off. Well, thanks very much. And it's true. He didn't say anything apart from just acknowledging the skipper when he called through to each crew section position to say he was there, and that was it. Didn't hear any more about him, and nothing at briefing or anything. Most peculiar chap. But we had him twice, and he was still a spare after I got shot down. And I was speaking to a chap that ended up in my billet up in East Prussia. I said, what's this chap doing? He said, oh, he's still a spare. But not long ago, all the other chaps had scrubbed him because he never washed himself. So they disrobed him and scrubbed him down. So a most peculiar fellow. And he doesn't appear on the roll of honour. So presumably he must have survived the war. One of these chaps, he probably did about 100 ops as a spare, I don't know. But that the sort of little things that used to go on, you see.
Now, you did these two raids on Cologne.
Yes.
And then you had a period of leave.
We had 6 days leave, which was a routine leave after every 6 weeks or something like that, we got leave.
And what would you do on your leave?
Well, I just went home. All the rest of the crew went back to their homes, and I just potted about, saw friends, and went to local pubs and had drinks and stuff like that. And for the 6 days.
Now the next thing is the three raids on Hamburg, part of Operation Gomorrah, which you went to. And we'd like to use these to look at sort of the whole makeup of a raid. You know, I don't know which one you remember best, but they're on the 24th of July and the next morning, the 27th of July and the 29th of July. Mm. And in between, there's a raid on Essen you went on the 25th of July, 26th of July.
Yes.
I don't know. If we look at a typical raid, I mean, I don't know whether you can separate them in your head. We'll perhaps talk about what happened to it. But how would it... Take me through the whole process of a typical raid.
Well, you would... What would happen... This, I would have imagined this would apply to most squadrons, but I'm talking obviously particularly about our squadron. You go down to the flights, a flight office, in the morning, around about 10 o'clock, say, after breakfast, and you would look to see if the battle order was up for that night. If it wasn't up by, say, 11 o'clock, then you reckon you were going to be stood down for that night. If it was up, and it was a maximum effort, all the crew, say 18 crews, would be of the battle order, and there'll be time for briefing, say 8 o'clock briefing. So
at night, obviously. Yeah.
Yes, in the evening, and then.
What would you do for the rest of the day? What would we do then?
Knowing now that we were on that night, we would all do an NFT, a night flying test.
Now, what's a night flying test?
Well, that means everything in the aircraft would be checked. We would roar over the. We used to do it over the wash. The skipper would bounce the aircraft around a bit, make sure everything was okay. And the rear gunner would fire our guns, check that our guns were okay. Sometimes our wireless operator, Bill Wells, who was also an air gunner, qualified air gunner, he would ask me if he could have a go at my guns, so he would fire off a few rounds as well. And then having done that and beaten up a few seagulls and so on, we would come back to base. This would then be early afternoon, possibly. And we would go to tea around about 4 o'clock. I used to, having fired the guns, they were now dirty, of course, and there was a bit of ammunition had been used up. So what I used to do, instead of getting our armourer to do it, I used to go over. By now, the airfield was absolutely dead quiet. There wasn't a movement anywhere. Everybody was back in their billets and so on and so forth, including the ground crew, after their tea and so on. So I used to bowl over to the aircraft. I used to take out the ammunition pans, one each side, and I would take them over to the armoury, and I would make up the belts with new ammunition. So there'd be loose ammunition and the links there. So you'd join them all up by hand and then put them through this machine where you turn the handle and the things come out and push them all and leveled all the rounds off. And I'd make up my rounds. I used to like to have two tracers together. And then, say, armour piercing, incendiary, and what they call ball. So that was what I did. And then when I got them back to the aircraft and put the pans back in their positions, I would then clean the guns.
How?
We had a rod with a pull-through rod. We take the breech block out, pull-through rod, and some bits of like flannel material, which went through like a big needle, eye of a needle. Clean the guns like that, and then I invariably reharmonized them as well, which meant we had a harmonization board with big spots painted on it, LAS. And that, when you've got them a certain distance from the aircraft, that represented, say, 600 yards. So I would then harmonise the guns, which did alter with vibration. So I used to harmonise so that the cone of fire was about 600 yards in front. And that's what the harmonisation board did for you. You lined up, you looked through the barrels of your guns.
They're Brownings, I would just
Brownings,
check
303 Brownings. Yeah. Look through the barrels. And line them up with the big dots on this big board. Thus, so you now, if you can imagine it, the guns are now like that, so that 600 yards ahead, your cone of fire was there. That would be the heaviest way to fire on an enemy airplane. So that was it. And then after
did everybody do this?
No, most people would get the armourers to do it, but I just like to do it myself. So after doing that, potted back to the billet. And then comes 8 o'clock.
Would you try and get some sleep? I mean, was that considered?
No, I don't know of anybody that got any sleep. I certainly didn't.
Was that because of nerves? Or, I mean, is that why?
Well, it was during the. It was during the day anyway, so a bit difficult to. No, I would just pot around over the mess, perhaps have a drink, or whatever, and then 8 o'clock or whenever it was, usually around about eight at that time. We would bowl round to the briefing room, and we would all sit down there. The skipper's names were called out, and they would just acknowledge that all their crews were there. And then the CO and the briefing officer would be up on the stage. They would reveal the target, so you see the red tapes, going to the dreaded Ruhr or somewhere, and the usual sighs will go up, a crow, that sort of nonsense, you know. And then the Met officer would come on to the usual jeers and boos, because it was always expected to be wrong anyway. Tell us what the weather would be like over the target and at base when we returned. Briefing would be, well, fairly brief, really. Tell us where we're going, what sort of markers we've got, what the colours of the day were, because if there were any naval ships in the vicinity on the way back, they were very gun-happy, I'm afraid, trigger-happy. So it was quite routine for a lot of, we never did it, but a lot of the chaps you'd see as we were approaching the English coast coming on, all the colours of the day going off to let anybody know that we were friendly. So all the little things were the routine stuff, you see. And so that was it, the briefing over.
I presume it was mainly for the pilot and the navigator. They had the most, and the bombing.
Oh, yes, because the navigator would have a separate briefing, short briefing, so they can map out his course and so on and so forth. Then, of course, the bomb aimer would have to know about all the what markers we were going for and so on and so forth, and what sort of bomb load we had. To the gunners, it was just a general briefing, really, as part of all the, just merely as part of the crew. So that being done, we would all bowl off to we'd go to the hangar, pick up our kit. We had lockers in the hangar.
What, your flying kit?
A flying kit.
And what was your flying kit?
Ermine jacket, leather flying jacket, flying boots. Flying boots are kept in the billet because we're obviously walking about with those on. Ermine jacket, parachute harness, parachute and helmet, flying helmet, and flying sweater. We had thick flying sweaters as well, apart from our thick flying socks.
Any other thing? What about gloves?
Gloves, three pairs of gloves, leather gauntlet gloves, woolen gloves and silk gloves. But I just used to wear possibly the silk gloves because you get your fingers into the...
So you pick up your flying kit.
So pick up your flying kit and then wander out and mill about. That film, The Bite of Bit, shows exactly what we did when we came out.